Oyster. I've been telling you many stories about its fabled history and illustrious reputation, how it has appeared in literature and what powers people believed it contained. If you've ever eaten an oyster, then I'm sure you probably have heard the adage that it's best to eat it during the months that end with R. To keep up with the demands of summer tourism, aquafarms on the eastern shore of Virginia enable restaurants to serve oysters throughout the entire year. However, there is definite truth and background to this adage. Months that end in R, September, October, November, and December, months when the atmosphere and bodies of water are cooler. In a simple explanation, it's easier during the fall and winter months to keep oysters fresh, especially oysters on the half shell, which are usually kept on a bed of ice. It's both functional and appealing to the eye. During the warmer summer months, oysters are typically spawning. Oysters are protandric, meaning they don't have a fixed sex for life. They are not male nor female, and in fact can change sexes over the course of their lifetime. Eggs and sperm are both created in an oyster's reproductive system. After reaching maturation, which takes about 1 year, oysters usually release sperm into the water around them. After building up the necessary energy reserves, which can take another few years, their reproductive organs begin to release eggs. Spawning naturally requires the oyster to be in a group. When one releases sperm into the water, it jumpstarts others to do the same. Older oysters begin to release eggs into the communal area. Sometimes a single oyster can create hundreds of millions of eggs during the cycle. Releasing eggs is far more energy consuming, which is why an oyster must mature for more than a year before its reproductive organs can handle the task. So much for a boring and simple creature, huh? You won't get sick from eating an oyster while it's in the spawning process, but the meat will probably be translucent and have a watery, weak flavor. By the time the months ending in R roll around, oysters have had time to mature. If left untouched by the next summer and spawning season, they will continue to reproduce and grow, therefore developing a richer and saltier flavor. Telling consumers to eat oysters during the winter months began centuries ago, but not because of an in-depth understanding of oyster maturation. Growers and sellers knew oysters were better and fatter during the winter months, but understanding why was not important. My point in going into a much further than necessary description of oyster reproduction? The oyster is forgiving. It will continue to thrive as long as it remains in a community with other oysters, despite what humans have done to it for centuries. Because of the filtration of its surrounding water, the oyster leaves its habitat in a better condition than before. Maybe we could all learn something from the little mollusk. I'm Lexi Hubb, and this is the Bivalve Trail Podcast. In 1839, a law was put into place restricting oyster sales occurring from May through September. I haven't mentioned this law previously because it was almost completely ignored. After the cholera outbreak and oyster scare of the 1850s, the mayor of New York City, Henry Wood, tried to rigorously enforce this law. He advised citizens to only eat oysters during the R-ending months in an effort to put an end to over-harvesting and allow time for the oyster beds to restore the supply. Of course, his directions were again largely ignored. No one understood the intricate biology behind it, and the debate about how useful this advisory was continued for decades. But after wiping out the entire oyster population of the New York Harbor in less than 100 years, all sellers were concerned with was the need for more oysters. Today, oysters are reproducing again in the Hudson River around New York City, but they're not meant for eating. A nonprofit educational program called the Billion Oyster Project is restoring the oyster reefs. Among biological benefits of river filtration, oyster reefs create a habitat for many species of underwater creatures. In a practical sense, the growing reef provides protection for the city from storm damage. Reefs can soften large waves, reduce flooding, and prevent erosion. Many food historians consider the time that was the heyday of Downing's Oyster House, between 1825 and 1855, to be the greatest age of American cuisine. Oysters were everywhere. The wealthy bankers and businessmen who wanted an elegant dining affair were flocking to Thomas Downing's establishment. For the polar opposite end of the social spectrum, there were the dark and gingy oyster sellers. But for the folks in between, what we call the middle class today, there had not been an obvious place for them to go and feast on oysters. I explained in the previous episode that because large corporations also wanted in on the booming oyster industry, and rent for land by the harbor was so expensive, two-story barges were appearing along the docks. I'm assuming a boat slip was much less expensive. As barges began appearing by the dozens, a floating marketplace for oysters emerged. Within the marketplace, oyster stands were also popping up. In fact, Cornelius Vanderbilt, the railroad and shipping tycoon who was born and raised on Staten Island, started building his fortune in maritime transportation by hauling oysters to Manhattan. If you've been to New York City, then you're probably all too familiar with seeing hot dog stands on almost every street corner. However, during the 1800s, streets were sporadically marked with simply constructed oyster stands. At these stands, oysters were a penny each. Oyster stew was 10 cents. Longshoremen, sailors, fishermen, and other market sellers were common clientele. Neighborhood marketplaces and oyster stands catered to a different class of people and were a reflection of the budding diversity in New York City's population. Oysters were still the epitome of New York living, and now bivalve indulgers could go to the markets to satisfy their desires for the salty morsels all day and even late into the night. At Downing's Oyster House at No. 5 Broad Street, Thomas presented to his loyal and aristocratic clientele the most succulent and flavorful oysters that could be offered and in the most delicious of ways. One such delight was oysters roasted on a large gridiron over oak shavings. Downing's oysters had a taste imparted by the saline and lime substances, in which the juice of the oyster reached boiling heat that made it a delicate morsel, one truly worthy to be borne to the lips that sipped from the shell the nectarous might. Thomas shipped oysters all across the Atlantic. In Europe, his selection of the choicest oysters went to Queen Victoria. Fried oysters, prepared at the Oyster House, were sent all the way to France for Colonel Armand Thorne. These fried oysters were a part of the spread at his exquisite receptions in Paris, which were said to stand out in regal splendor and be beyond the best. The oysters, having been prepared on one side of the Atlantic and shipped across to the other side, tasted as though prepared there for the occasion. Pickled oysters were also sent to the West Indies. Without modern refrigeration technology, shipping these oysters across the Atlantic and maintaining their freshness could not have been an easy feat. Whatever his clients wanted, Thomas Downing delivered. An 1855 clipping from the New York Evening Post read,
"To those who do not know Mr. Downing, given that everyone knows him here, it may be proper to say that he is one of the most respectable and aged colored men in this city. His private character is without reproach. He has made a large fortune as the keeper of a refectory, which is frequented daily by throngs of the principal bankers and merchants of Wall and Broad Streets in their vicinity. And during his long and uninterrupted success, has never forgotten the humility and modesty, which are his most noticeable characteristics. And it would be difficult to detect the slightest change wrought in the character or deportment of the old man since he became what he has been for many years, a man of fortune, except in the magnitude of his donations for the relief of his oppressed race."
The Weekly Anglo-African, printed in 1859,
That Thomas Downing, by his long-standing and strict integrity, has proved himself worthy of and receives the highest respect of every man, colored or white. In this city and throughout the country, whose good fortune is to know him, is most true.
The native of the eastern shore of Virginia and born on Chincoteague built his success on the oyster, something he knew since he was a young man and better than any of his peers. Thomas eventually retired, and his eldest son George took over running the family business. Though retired and knowing how strongly he felt about the success of the Oyster House, coupled with maintaining its reputation as a favorite resort of distinguished parties, I can't imagine Thomas stayed away very much. I think he probably remained quite present and visited daily to check on his clientele, who he spent decades catering to and offering a great repast. I'm sure he also wanted to stay in the loop on the daily happenings because we can all pretty much assume that when businessmen got together around a table and were feasting on some raw and roasted oysters, they did a lot of talking. Downing's was known for being the place to learn the latest tidbits of news items and info, and the men granted this knowledge to Thomas. They didn't need a social media news feed to learn the goings-on, so the movers and shakers of the New York financial and business industries went to the Oyster House to get their fill of gossip from Thomas. Thomas Downing, never one to push himself to the forefront except in business, had clout. There were rumors, good rumors, that he had the effect of drawing many office seekers to the Oyster House, who treated Downing with the marked respect usually bestowed on the power behind the throne. It was whispered that Downing had influence at the Custom House, Post Office, and City Hall, and was known for being eminently trustworthy. Thomas was outspoken when it came to his beliefs and sentiments, and was very good at quick banter and conversation. His son George wrote about his father, he told a good joke, he took pains to make himself familiar with men and events, he was related through his business with the prominent events of the day, described as a commanding figure, kingly bearing, and a manly character. I think it's appropriate to call Thomas Downing the Oyster King of New York. After a series of strokes, Thomas Downing died, highly honored, on April 10, 1866. He was 75 years old. There are not a lot of details about him in the last years of his life. I can only infer from the lack of information and a clipping I found from a nameless newspaper that reads,
"He knew intimately every New Yorker of prominence up to the days of the Civil War."
Perhaps this means nothing, and maybe his health was declining and kept him indoors. If that's the case, it very well could have protected him from experiencing horrible and malicious incidents taking place around New York during the bloody Civil War. Violent race riots were not infrequent. African Americans were blamed for the slaughter and suffering inflicted on the Unionist troops, and were randomly lynched and murdered out on the city streets as an unfair reactionary response. Drawing a conclusion from his son's account, Thomas was spared gruesome violence, and his death was said to have been lamented by all who knew him, and brought forth fond memories and many words of reflection. If your career was spent catering to the white elite, many of whom were owners and writers of newspapers, it is understandable why there are so many printed laments following his death. Thomas's remains were brought to St. Philip's Episcopal Church for his funeral. This church, originally called the Free African Church of St. Philip's, was the only black congregation at the time and where Thomas and his family went to worship and regularly attend sermons. At the end of each episode, I've told you to visit a webpage for my list of sources and to check out the image of Thomas Downing. That image, which is the only one I can find, is a line drawing from his obituary. The respect for Thomas that I've been explaining over and over again continued beyond his death, as this drawing and short obituary was printed in the New York Times. That alone is an honor and an amazing accomplishment in a divided America for a person of color. The obituary reads,
"Mr. Thomas Downing, the well-known colored caterer, died at his residence in the city on Tuesday. The funeral will take place on Friday next at 1:30 p.m. at St. Philip's Church in Mulberry Street."
His remains were carried from the church to his final resting place at the St. Philip's section of Cypress Hills Cemetery in Brooklyn. According to George,
they were followed by a cortege of his fellow citizens from all classes. The occasion spoke of a universal esteem in which he was held. There were present in the throng not only the cultivated, the religious, and the moral of society, but those who were less respected. The inhabitants of all abodes, the inebriate who was sober for the occasion, all were there with humility upon their countenances to pay respect to the generosity, virtue, and general goodness that was true of him and whose death they mourned. For he had a kind heart for all. Sorrow could be seen upon those who bore hard vigils.
Here's what the New York Times printed about the funeral.
Long lines of carriages, well filled with mourners, multiple delegations, Freemasons in full regalia. Crowds filled the streets in front of the church, which was packed from door to pulpit for a chance to view for the last time the face of him who was well known to all.
I want to point out that the Freemasons in attendance were members of the New York Prince Hall Masons. Members of the National Masonic Order wouldn't accept African Americans as members, so Prince Hall, a leader in Boston's free black community, founded a new branch during the late 1700s. Downing was a member of this branch, called the New York Prince Hall Masons, and the Grand Master at the time of his death, Peter Ray, led the delegations who were in attendance. Another grand honor? The Board of Commerce of the City of New York, now known as the Chamber of Commerce, closed for the day and adjourned to attend the funeral.
The humble person who dies thus respected started to plow through life's rough seas with a bark freighted only with a good name, an iron constitution, with an indomitable perseverance. He left home a youth with a pack on his back. Two sons survived the departed. One was educated in France, the other at home.
This last passage briefly mentioned Thomas Downing's children. We know his eldest son, George, but the others, Thomas Jr. and Henry, who were twins, Jane and Peter William, we know very little about them. They were all born in New York City and educated in the African free schools, which Thomas was active in establishing. There is also very little written about Thomas's wife, Rebecca, except for in a biography of George. Rebecca is described as highly respected and known for her benevolence, determination of character, and queenly grace. I think it's appropriate here to state the adage, "Behind every good man is a great woman." The great man of oysters indeed died a wealthy man. He was said to have over $100,000 in the bank, which is equivalent to over $1.6 million today. He reportedly made considerable money investing in railroad stock. However, Downing had a great sense of responsibility and was philanthropic, as I discussed in the previous episode. He gave generously to his church. George explained he contributed freely to the needy. His beneficence was not restricted by race, nationality, or color. Like other entrepreneurs in the catering industry, He created many jobs for African-American cooks and waiters. Even 2 decades after his death, the Cleveland Gazette described him in 1887 as
a remarkable character in the history of New York for more than half a century.
But let's not downplay how through perseverance, diligent obedience to his oysterman comrades, and during an era of slavery, Thomas Downing built an empire. His establishment attracted wealthy financiers and newspapermen who brought their wives and family to dine. He served visiting dignitaries, merchants, and travelers from different countries. He was a favorite with the captains who sailed oyster boats. He paid them very well and treated them in a generous manner when they came to his house. Why do I keep going on about how much Thomas Downing was liked? Because in all of my research, there were quotations and eulogies describing how nice of a guy he was. I'm a little sad I never got to meet him. The legacy of Thomas Downing lived on. His son George operated Downing's until around 1871, when the uniqueness of the Oyster House faded into the pages of history, as trends often do. It would be fondly remembered as an early New York institution. Thanks to the dozens of oyster stands at neighborhood marketplaces, oysters were more popular and accessible than ever before. Considered a food staple of New York, consumption remained intense. Around 1,500 boats were constantly utilized to obtain a supply for the city alone. More and more people were eating oysters and then were compelled to write about the experience. American journalist John Kieran noted, "An oyster of medium size and in top condition, served cold on the flat half shell and ingested with a dash of lemon, is food for the gods." Oysters are not as popular in New York City anymore, but the tradition of feasting on them continues at the Grand Central Oyster Bar inside the Grand Central Terminal train station. You'll probably pay more for it, but the novelty of eating a world-famous Chincoteague salt oyster in New York is an experience to be had.
This image of a prominent leader of his community and of someone who held firm views on the injustices of the day is replicated in the words of his eldest son, George, who himself followed in his father's footsteps, taking over the oyster business, and then becoming a very successful restaurateur in his own right, with good connections with the white political establishments of Rhode Island, Boston, and Washington. He was said to have inherited his father's commanding figure and kingly bearing, his aggressive temperament, and manly character. He was reared under Christian influences and taught to stand up for his rights as well as of the weaker ones, and repel invasion by force if necessary.
As I explained before, Thomas, considered one of the most intelligent and leading spirits among the colored men of the United States, fought for equity and for the equal exercise of the right of suffrage for people of color. Unfortunately, Downing passed away before the 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution, which granted equal suffrage for African-American men, passed in 1870. Though he may not feel he saw a lot of progress during his lifetime, Downing's protesting and social activism was not for naught. On April 9, 1866, the day before Thomas Downing died, the U.S. House of Representatives overturned President Andrew Johnson's veto of the Civil Rights Bill of 1866. This was the first time Congress legislated upon civil rights. President Johnson disagreed with the level of federal intervention by the legislation, and in his veto message called it another step, or rather a stride, towards centralization and the concentration of all legislative power in the national government. The legislation granted all American citizens, regardless of color, the full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property. Representative Henry Raymond of New York noted that the legislation was one of the most important bills ever presented to this House for its action. Thomas Downing may have been ill and unaware of what was transpiring in Washington, D.C., but unbeknownst to him, he passed away an equally protected United States citizen. How beautiful is that? When we look back at Thomas Downing's life, there is a lot to reflect upon. This kid from the Eastern Shore, who grew up working in the oyster beds like most of the men during his time, left home and headed to Philadelphia having no particular skill other than his showmanship and knowledge of oysters. He falls in love, gets married, and his aspirations to broaden his opportunities lead him to New York City. He continues to work with oysters and sell his crops to dingy oyster sellers until he decides he wants to redefine the industry. He opens an oyster house in the heart of the financial district. His customers are members of the elite, bankers, financiers, owners of newspapers, journalists, individuals who are white and influential. His establishment is very popular. After 10 years, he expands. He becomes the sought-after caterer of parties and New Year's Eve dinners. He is hired to cater the elaborate gala welcoming Charles Dickens to the United States. Because of Thomas, oysters are now classy and food for the upper echelons of society. He ships oysters overseas to Queen Victoria and other foreign dignitaries. His business survives a tragic cholera outbreak and comes out on top. He puts Chincoteague oysters on the map and is probably why they start shipping to northern U.S. cities. He is incredibly successful and becomes very wealthy. He uses his fortune to support and better his community. The lowest level of his oyster house becomes a stop on the Underground Railroad. He tirelessly fights for equal rights for all Americans, for suffrage, for education, for the ability to ride all public transportation safely. He is adored and respected by everyone. His death is lamented, all during an age of terrible racism and harsh segregation. His legacy is one worthy of being written in history books, used in museum exhibits, memorialized as a statue. Thomas Downing had something in common with the oyster. He left the world a better place than he found it. Let's not allow for Thomas Downing to be swallowed up again by the passing of centuries and the suppression of African American history. That's it for this episode of The Bivalve Trail and the story of Thomas Downing. Thank you for joining me on this adventure down this rabbit hole. I hope you've enjoyed meeting and learning about the life of Thomas Downing and agree with why, after 4 years of researching, I felt telling his amazing story now was necessary. I hope you also liked learning about the history, culture, and biology of the oyster, as well as developed an appreciation for them. I know I did. The next time you sit down to partake in a dozen oysters on the half shell, take a moment to remember Thomas, and how much you now know about the unsuspecting mollusk, and how important it was to him. I also invite anyone who is a Downing or has information about Thomas and his family to please reach out to me. I'd love to learn more. The Bivalve Trail is researched and written by me, Lexi Hubb. Script editing by Kathy Hubb and Justin Eric. Podcast artwork by Angie Hetty. Recording and post-production by Longtail Studios. The excellent music by Bill Troxler. Additional vocals from James Rich, Cliff Merton, and Tom Nolan. The Bivalve Trail is a production of the Chincoteague Island Theater Company and our parent organization, the Chincoteague Cultural Alliance. Thank you to our project partner, the Museum of Chincoteague Island. Please keep sharing the Bivalve Trail with your friends, family, or anyone who likes a good story and appreciates history. Be sure to visit chincoteaguega.org/bivalvetrail.html for my list of sources. There's also a picture of me standing where, according to Google Maps, is number 5 Broad Street and where Downing's Oyster House once stood. There's also the only image of Thomas Downing that exists, and lastly, a photo of a horse-drawn trolley car where our scene took place in episode 3. Though this is the conclusion of the narrative of Thomas Downing, the Bivalve Trail Audible series is not over. The Shingatig Island Theater Company will return soon with something in place of our annual winter play, since we can't experience live theater together and be a community in person. Stay tuned for more information. Until next time.